Hello once again, faithful listener, and welcome to the Small Voice podcast for January. Yes, our very first offering in 2018. Chings, it'll be 8:30 before you know it. My name is Darren, and joining me here in the studio are Margaret.
Hello.
And Anne.
Hello.
So whether you're tall, dark, handsome, or none of the above, we'll say a hail and happy new year to you, and thanks for first footing and bringing us some black bun. This has got very Scottish, hasn't it? Don't worry, there'll be subtitles on the red button, I promise. This month we are ridiculously excited to be able to bring you a special live studio session from none other than the Ayoub Sisters, who are fresh from touring with Gareth Malone, topping the iTunes Classical Singles chart, releasing their debut album on the Decca label, and just generally being really rather wonderful. Plus, of course, our regular features, A Thousand Words and Small Voice of the Month. Meanwhile, in our media review, we are looking at Rebecca Stott's prize-winning memoir, In the Days of Rain, and rest assured we'll round things off, as ever, with the bun fest that is our moral mixdown. And there will be no Trump impressions, I assure you, and people are very happy to hear that. Before we begin, of course, our listeners demand to know if we are well. Has the month been heavenly or hell? Anne, over to you.
Well, how could it be anything but heaven, since it contained Christmas Day? And we had our community Christmas lunch, as usual. This year, about 50 people turned up for lunch. So it was a three turkey lunch, and it was a fantastic day. And when we got home, there was Mitzi the cat waiting for us. We were cat sitting for the family. So a perfect Christmas day.
Perfect. Margaret?
I've had a bit of everything, I suppose, as usual, but I thought I should really give a mention to the Heavenly Choir. They were in the programme as the Heavenly Choir, who were a bunch of singers, just a small number, who included my husband, which makes it, of course, heavenly. But they were taking part in a wonderful musical version of The Nativity, written by a chap who is now a priest in Livingston. He used to be a priest in Falkirk, which is how we got to know him. But it involved everybody from a very young baby to much older people. And we had a wicked Herod and his henchmen as well. And it was fabulous. So good fun.
There we go. Two heavens. Can we make it three? Well, you know, at this point, I would like everyone to spare a thought for those of us in the month of January who live with people who are not necessarily the biggest fans of the darkness. And I have to say, I'm not going to say that things have been hellish, but I'm conscious that there are weeks to go yet before some of our partners emerge fully and happily into the Scottish spring, shall we say. And some people cope with the darkness better than others. The log fire is helping. The cat is helping. Hang in there. We will get there. I'll put this down as purgatory. That's the best I'm offering. Now, in our mailbag this month, we have a hello from Katrina, our most faithful of faithful listeners, who thanked us for making her think and making her laugh in the December podcast. You are most welcome as ever, Katrina. And thank you, by the way, for the panda, which I think you gave as a gift to Anne and Brian. And it's actually sitting looking at us. It's a porcelain panda. And believe it or not, on the base, I think it says made in the USSR. So it's quite an old panda as well. We also want to say hello to self-confessed long-time lurker Andrew Steele, who decloaked just long enough to pop by our website to say thanks for a stimulating hour. Thank you, Andrew. We really do appreciate you taking the time to get in touch. And if anyone else fancies owning up to listening to the show or wants to give us feedback, do please visit our website smallvoice.org.uk, or you can tweet us on Twitter at small_voice1. Our media review this month features the memoir In the Days of Rain by Rebecca Stott, which has just won the Costa Prize for Best Biography 2017. The blurb from the publisher says that the book is an enthralling, at times shocking and deeply personal family memoir of growing up in and breaking away from a fundamentalist Christian cult. The cult in question is the Exclusive or Closed Brethren, and Rebecca traces the history of this cult or sect, if you're feeling generous, before moving on to her own family's involvement with them. Here's an extract from the book read by Anne, which deals with what happens to Rebecca and her family when they decide to leave the cult.
Many people assume that leaving a cult like the Brethren must be exhilarating. You had no TV or pop music or cinema, they say, and then you did. It must have been amazing. But when you see interviews with people who have recently left cults, they describe feeling bewildered and frightened. Their eyes dart around, searching for points of reference, metaphors that would get somewhere close to describing feeling lost, not at home, without walls. No one, of course, shrugs off years of indoctrination in one go. Many escapees went back to the Brethren after a few weeks, not only because they missed their families, which would be reason enough, or because they didn't have the skills to get work, but because the world frightened them. You can't just refuse to believe that the world belongs to Satan if you've heard it repeated over and over since you were born. It's under your skin. People also describe the difficulty of making choices, moral, financial, domestic, professional and emotional, because inside the Brethren, there are virtually no choices to make. The language that non-Brethren speak seems different too. At 8 years old, I did not know how to talk to other children at school, or how to bridge the void between their world and mine. I was pretty certain the rapture was still coming. After all, no one had told me otherwise. But I had no idea who'd be taken, now that my parents had started to watch television and films and go to other churches. I'd stand with my back to the wall in the playground, watching the children skipping rope, singing their complicated rhymes, and I'd be conjuring tribulation scenarios, imagining tidal waves sweeping across the tarmac, storms tearing down the playground walls, the four horsemen galloping across rooftops, lights out and sea levels rising.
Thanks, Han. Now, I don't normally start with what I thought of the book. I'm just going to lay out there. And so much comes back to me just hearing you read that out. I thought this was an amazing book. I'm not sure I will read a better book this year, which is kind of maybe pitching it a bit high. I don't know. So no pressure. But Margaret, because I think Anne's got a very personal response to this book. But first of all, Margaret, what did you think?
I found it, certainly as a whole, very interesting, very thought-provoking. There are a lot of things that the book brings up, and the part that Anne's just read, I suppose, could be replicated. Those feelings of estrangement are perhaps what you'd expect from somebody coming from a different background altogether, coming as a refugee to another country, for example, except that they were in their own country and felt a bit strange. What I perhaps didn't entirely expect when I started reading it was a link with a book that I read last year, which was actually the Costa Biography Prize winner last year, called Dadland. And the title gives you some kind of clue. It was another woman trying to find out about her father and perhaps unravel the mystery that this father had been. And there were actually some similarities in the lives, that nothing to do with the faith aspect of the book at all, but the idea of somebody trying to find out about her own father in a relationship which went fine and then kind of fell apart as she was getting older. So I flippantly rather wondered if there's a new genre coming up of women writing about their fathers.
Writing about their fathers, yeah. Now, Anne, I said that you had a very kind of personal, almost want to say visceral, I don't know if that's selling it too much, reaction to the book. Do you want to explain or tell us?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to say, first of all, it is an extraordinary book. I wouldn't want to say anything otherwise, and wholly deserved to be the biography of the year in the Costa Prize. And it's worth just re-emphasising what Margaret said. It starts out as a way of piecing together really memories of our father, telling our father's story, because this was a family that had been within the Exclusive Brethren for generations, and her grandfather and great-grandfather had been pretty high up in the hierarchy. But I found it almost oppressive to read, because it brought back a lot of stuff from my own childhood. Now, we weren't Brethren, we certainly weren't Exclusive Brethren, but I think my small-town Baptist church probably was quite heavily rather than influenced. And it was the way that the women, she describes the women being mm-hmm. treated, that brought back a lot. I mean, there were certainly no women in leadership of any kind except Sunday school in my childhood church. I would never have dreamt of going to church without covering my head. I mean, I wore a hat until my late teens, and anything else was unthinkable. And I realised after I had left that I had absorbed an idea of what a woman was supposed to be like, and it was essentially passive, almost mm-hmm. kind of beatific. You certainly weren't an agent of anything.
You couldn't be willful. That was apparently the worst thing to be
well,
described
yeah,
as.
Yeah. I mean, we've joked a lot about the submissive ways and stuff like that in the podcast, but it was a submissive role that women were supposed to take, and there were no women in leadership of any kind and in that church until comparatively recently, mm-hmm. until the last few years. And so I actually, it brought back a lot of stuff, which possibly I, like the writer of the book, still have within me. Because it's quite clear that Rebecca still carries with her some of the demons from that childhood and from that upbringing.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard to piece together quite what she thinks of faith. Now, I kind of get the sense that she's an atheist, but she doesn't push that heavily in the book. I don't know what you thought.
Not in the slightest.
It's quite difficult to pin that down. What struck me as really interesting was the names of her children, which I can't remember the detail of now, but they are all biblical names. And I think that's perhaps some indication of a bit of influence there. It is quite difficult, I think, when you've gone through that kind of turmoil, to establish where you actually are, where you belong. And she's found, I think, a sense of belonging now, which is not with any kind of fellowship, as far as I could work out.
I noticed that when she came out of the church, if you like, when she was in her teenage years, I think she made friends with a Catholic
yes.
family. And there's quite a moving bit in the book where she goes to her very first Catholic service, which, I mean, I can imagine, presumably, and you'll have been to a Catholic service and felt the same way. It's like, this is amazing, or this is terrifying, you know, because these people were the devil as far as the brethren were concerned.
That's right. And I mean, they were worse than atheists
in
that sense. And it is such an assault on the senses when the sort of Christianity you've been brought up in has nothing which could be described as pictorial or representative in any way. To go into a Catholic service and be hit by the imagery and the incense and all these incredibly sensual things, you almost don't know what to do.
Well, and she quotes, I think it's the bit in the service where they simply say, "Lord have mercy, Christ have mercy,
yeah.
Lord have mercy." And I think she starts crying.
She does, and she just weeps uncontrollably. I get that. I understand all that. And I think it's why I'm still now very drawn to liturgy, having had nothing that could be described as liturgical in my yeah. upbringing. And I think she clearly is too. But she's such a compassionate person, because I don't think it's giving too much away to say that, having left behind that structured world of the brethren, her father kind of falls to pieces. Mm. And in many ways is not a good father in any sense. But the way that she writes about him is so deeply compassionate mm-hmm. and understanding of what he went through. I find astonishing. There's real forgiveness,
yeah.
I think, in everything that she writes about all of her family, even down to understanding how a life like that within the Exclusive Brethren, people went to for good reasons. It was the kind of thing a young man who wanted to dedicate his life to God might find attractive. And she gets that.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
She understands that.
And I have to say, I think it will have particular resonance if you've been kind of near that kind of background.
Yeah.
And I think if you know nothing about the Close Brethren, then your jaw will literally be, not literally, it will be close to the floor reading
yeah.
this. It's an amazing book. I can't recommend it highly enough. So, In the Days of Rain by Rebecca Stott is published by HarperCollins and is now available in paperback from all good bookshops, and I dare say even a few bad ones. Time for some music, and we're delighted to be joined by the Ayoub sisters, Sarah and Laura.
Hello.
So hello.
Hello.
And it's weird because you are sisters, so you are the Ayub sisters, but you are now, air quotes, the Ayub sisters. Was that a long time deciding what you were going to be called? Was that an easy
not
one?
Not quite, although we do still get asked, are you really sisters, or is that just kind of a cool, hip band name, believe it or not?
So you're kind of genetically put together to be the perfect. Now, I was going to say there, perfect classical crossover. People have described you as that. Are you happy with that? You're a bit annoyed, classical music?
No, absolutely. Yeah, that's what we do. We're classically trained musicians, went to rigorous music school and conservatoires, but we do have a love for other genres, jazz, pop, Arabic, traditional Scottish, so we try and encompass that in a kind of coherent sound world. So yeah, I'd say classical crossover.
That is a pretty good answer. Now, I've got a simple question for you. Actually, it's not, it's going to take a while, but just to say, so Sarah, you graduated in 2014.
That's right.
From the RCS, and Laura, you were in London studying at the RCM, the
yep.
Royal College of Music. And so when did you, Sarah, go down to join Laura?
About 2 years ago, exactly. Laura was halfway through her bachelor degree and I'd finished in Scotland and lived my whole life in Glasgow, and I kind of had the London bug and wanted to explore what down south had in store.
Right, so you're now down in London, okay, mm-hmm. That's fine. Now, slight sideways move. I was wrapping my Christmas presents and I was just looking for something to watch. And I'd had some nice classical Christmas thing, and there was a thing on Sky Arts, and it was a classic Christmas, and there was a classic FM concert thing introduced by her that was on Strictly Come Dancing recently. We couldn't mm-hmm. dance terribly well, but she's a lovely person. And then the Ayub sisters were on. Now, I knew I was going to be interviewing you, but I think they're on the telly. So that was 2 years ago. You moved down to London.
Yes.
That's quite a couple of years. How'd you end up then being on the telly and famous and things?
It's been fast. I mean,
what was your New Year's resolution in 2016?
Oh gosh, I don't know if I had one, but yeah, a lot of things have happened in the last 2 years that's kind of led to this point now. Yeah, being in London, being together, Laura and I, we had a long distance relationship to begin with, trying to practice when we could and get together, but being together in the right city, doing something that's kind of unique to us as musicians, I think has helped us to move fast in our kind of path.
And when you were planning this, I mean, it's not like there would have been a big plan here. Presumably you thought we'll get together and see what happens, but you must be surprised by how well it's taken off. Would that be fair?
Yeah, that's definitely fair. That's more than fair. That's very accurate. It was never really pre-planned, any of this that's happened over the last year in particular. It was just come to London, let's play with each other in the same, under the same roof, and explore different creative opportunities, and one thing led to another, and we were given lots of platforms to be able to showcase our own music, and we're very grateful for that.
But it's a cutthroat world. If you weren't any good, you know, it says top of the iTunes classical music chart, you must be pretty chuffed.
We're very, very chuffed. We're just trying to kind of keep level headed, stay grounded, but it's all been very exciting.
And the big question, are the parents happy? Are they like, when are you going to get a proper job?
No, they're proud, of course, and very, very supportive. It's quite funny because Dad in particular had his reservations, rightfully so, about both of us following in a musical career path. But I think over the last year we've managed to show him that it is possible to make a living from music, and hopefully it continues.
Yeah. Now, do you want to tell us about the first piece of music that you're going to play for us?
The first piece of music we're going to play is Shardas, which is one of the pieces that we've been playing since we were very, very young. It's kind of the party piece of the Ayub household. It's the one that's often most requested. It's a Hungarian folk dance. It was one of the pieces for the grade 8 violin syllabus back in the day. And our album version actually has us playing all three instruments that we play between us, accompanied by symphony orchestra. But today we're going to do a stripped back violin cello version.
Okay, so this is Laura on violin and Sarah on cello, and this is going to be, hope I'm saying it right, Shardas.
Yes.
Okay, take it away.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah and Laura, thank you so much. That was the Ayoub Sisters with their first offering for us called Shardas. Time for our feature, A Thousand Words, where Anne asks a guest to speak about a picture which means a lot to them and to tell the story behind the picture and their contact with it. So, who have you been speaking to this month, Anne?
I've been speaking to Doug Gay. Now, Doug is our Church of Scotland minister and lecturer in practical theology at the University of Glasgow. And as you'll hear, he has a special interest also in liturgy and preaching and on alternative forms of worship. Here he is describing the photo he chose to bring into the studio.
So we're looking at an image of a woman who is standing, and in the picture there are also two children. And one of them is in a sling on the front of her body and may be breastfeeding or may just be sleeping. And with her right hand, the woman is leaning down and she has a spoon which has food in it. It looks like maybe some kind of porridge. And she is putting that into the mouth, the open mouth of an expectant child who's standing at her side. And that child is maybe 3 years old, 3 or 4 years old, I would say. It's a woman of colour, possibly from Southeast Asia somewhere, India, Myanmar, Indonesia possibly. And she's wearing a kind of simple cream-coloured top and a checked skirt in a fabric that's quite close to matching the fabric of the shawl in which the child is strapped to her front. And I would say also that you have the sense of looking at someone who is not a wealthy person. So when I look at it, I see a poor woman who is possibly simultaneously feeding two children, one baby and one toddler. I first came across this image, I think it would be around about 1991. I was part of a group in Glasgow called the Late Late Service, which was an alternative worship community. And one of the ideas at the heart of alternative worship was to open up the range of media that were used in worship. And so the services were highly visual. We usually met in the evening, hence the late, late service at 9 p.m. And the space we met in would have screens hung around it. And we would back project onto those screens. Back in those days, it was slide projectors that were being used. And one night during one of the services, this image was projected onto one of the screens at a particular moment in the worship, which is significant.
What was the moment?
Well, the moment was during the Lord's Prayer. There were some very unconventional elements in the way these worship services ran, but there were also some very conventional ones and some traditional liturgical elements like the Lord's Prayer and sometimes the Creed and other things like that. And the idea was that whatever theme we were exploring or whatever part of the service we were in, the visuals team were responsible for finding visuals that would help us to explore and go deeper into that theme. And so we used to use the Lord's Prayer most times we worshipped, and somebody in the visuals team decided that every time we had the Lord's Prayer, they were going to put this image on the screen. And so it developed this very strong association for me with the Lord's Prayer.
Why do you think they chose this image?
I think it was something to do with the imagery of feeding. When we pray the Lord's Prayer, we're thinking of God as someone who feeds us and takes care of us on a daily basis. I think the other thing that was going on was the Late Late Service. There was a lot of creativity, a lot of experimentation, and sometimes quite a subversive imagination. And one of the things people wanted to challenge was the way in which many of us grew up with a very strong understanding of the maleness of God. Now, my day job these days, I work as a theologian. And actually, if you go back into Orthodox theological tradition, although clearly we inherit a very strong tradition of calling God Father from the scriptures, theologically, people have always said that that you can't really attribute gender to God. God is beyond gender. And of course, in the creation story, when God creates humanity, male and female are both created in God's image, which also suggests that the image of God is something which transcends gender. So I think there was something subversive about this, and it was challenging, and it certainly disturbed me, but in a good way, unsettled me, because most of us can say the Lord's Prayer almost on autopilot, and that's as it should be. We memorize it, we remember it. And then there was this image alongside it, which was quite disruptive. And so it made me reflect on my image of God and pushed against this idea of a male image of God, which I think for people, certainly in my generation, probably still for many people in the church today, is a very strong and a very powerful thing. And it was absolutely to do with it being an image. It was the visual nature of it that pressed back against that. I think that people tend to police their doctrine maybe more through words than through images. And the image as well, it's very, in some ways it's very unchallenging. It just kind of sits there and it invites you to say, what do you make of this? And what do you make of this in this context? And it draws you out and it draws you in. This is also, I think, a strong picture. This is a strong woman whose life is probably not easy. And I think that part of the subversion of some of the images that we grow up with that aren't always helpful is that masculine images sometimes lack tenderness. They're over-assertive and they're anxious about strength. And, well, there are all kinds of ways in which women are depicted in images, but the idea of a woman who is strong and associating that with the image of God, I think has been a powerful thing for me and one that has returned to me in leading worship at different times. And so sometimes when I'm leading worship, I use an affirmation of faith which says, we believe in God who loves us with a mother's strength and a father's tenderness. And it's also the woman seems deeply absorbed in caring for the two children and very attentive to them. I mean, if you're going to feed two children simultaneously, you have to concentrate. But there was something about that and about the complete attentiveness of her to their needs, which I think was a very powerful picture for me of God and of God's care for creation and for human beings. And God's care for me, I suppose, because it was something that I internalized. So though it's a picture that comes from a culture and a place that's very far away from the one I come from, somehow this became part of my image of God. And so I feel profoundly grateful to the people who messed with my image of God using this picture, because I think it's been very creative and helpful for me.
Fascinating stuff, and definitely a theme emerging over a few thousand words, if I may say, Anne. So if folks are wanting to take a look at Doug's photo, where can they find it?
Yeah, it's on the Small Voice website, mm-hmm. as always. And if you want to take a look at a few other images from the past few months that people have suggested that might also mess with your image of God, could I recommend maybe the painting called Emmaus by Emmanuel Garibay, which was part of the Jesus Laughing exhibition. You might remember Dave Tomlinson mm-hmm. chose that. There's Our Last Supper by Ian Campbell, which is having such a profound effect here in Glasgow. The Pensive Christ, chosen by Norman Shanks, which has become almost the national image of Lithuania. And even Jim Gordon's choice, which was Rublev's icon of the Trinity, does mess with the image of God a little bit. So have a look back through past month's podcast and you'll find these alternative images all at smallvoice.org.uk.
Regular listeners will know that each month in the podcast we take time to celebrate a person or organisation that may have a small voice, but which nevertheless manages to make a big difference locally or globally. Yes, it's our Small Voice of the Month, doing exactly what it says on the tin. Margaret, what have you found for us this month?
Well, I didn't go very far this time, Darren. The Wild Olive Tree Cafe is not far at all from where we are right now, inside St George's Tron Church. And Anne's just mentioned the painting by Ian Campbell, the Our Last Supper. That and other works are in there as well. The church is within sight of the Royal Concert Hall in the City Chambers, round the corner from Glasgow's two major railway stations, and with shops and restaurants on all sides. In just 2 years, the cafe has acquired a reputation for its soup and its scones, but it has much more to offer than food. It's a social enterprise working with agencies which care for people in need, homeless, refugees, people on the margins. It invites customers to donate a coffee or a plate of soup to someone who can't afford it. And it offers training, volunteering opportunities and a chance to experience the world of work. Well, I went along to sample the coffee, of course, and to speak to the manager, Beth Duncan. And I asked her why she's running a cafe inside a church.
The church set the cafe up in the first place, and although the cafe runs sort of independently of the church in the sense that there's a manager and the staff and we kind of run it ourselves, it's in partnership with the church, and we've had, over the years, we've had volunteers from the church who actually come and work in the cafe. But the cafe uses the building Monday to Saturday, and then the church uses the building exclusively on a Sunday. But on a Wednesday lunchtime, there's a service that goes on while the cafe is running, and we have glass screens that we put across, but there's still people sitting in the sanctuary space, you know, who can come in and maybe wouldn't otherwise come into a church service, but are happy to kind of sit on the edge and maybe just listen while they're having their lunch. And and in terms of what the cafe is about, it's the church really sees it as a ministry of the church, in terms of wanting to just open the doors and invite people to come into a church building who wouldn't necessarily otherwise, but also this kind of extending an outreach opportunity to people in need is really a ministry of the church as well. I mean, I love what we do. Like, I've been in hospitality for over 10 years. I've worked in a lot of different cafes and coffee shops, and you know, there's a mundane aspect to the job. It's, we run a cafe, we serve people, we clear dirty dishes, and you know, all the mundane things that comes with the job. But I wouldn't want to be doing this kind of work anywhere else now, because knowing that we're coming in and we're actually helping people that genuinely need it, and as well as that, the team is wonderful, and it's become a real community in terms of the people that we work with, the regular customers that come in, and then the guys that come in that we help as well. It's just, it makes it worthwhile, you know, and especially knowing that it's making a small difference. It can be difficult, it can be frustrating, feeling like, oh, we're really not addressing the bigger needs. There's only so much that anyone can do, but playing a small part, I think, is important, and that matters.
Well, you'll be able to hear more of the interview in our next podcast extra in a couple of weeks' time. Now, Anne, I think you've sampled the soup and the scones.
I certainly have. In my view, any cafe which has as its motto coffee, soups and scones done right can only be a good thing, and they are done right. They are delicious. And there is something about when you go up to pay your bill, being able to say, and I'd like to pay for a coffee, or I'd like to pay for soup for a homeless person. It just makes you enjoy your own soup and scone even more, even more. So, and it's a lovely space. That's the other thing. It's a lovely space to be in. So I thoroughly recommend it. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, there are other organisations, for example, Social Bite.
Yes.
Certainly in Edinburgh. I think they're all
Glasgow,
over, aren't they?
Yeah. You know,
and they're getting a lot of media attention. I think the guy who runs that's pretty smart on the media. You know, you get George Clooney along, but it's nice as a model that kind of pay it forward, isn't it? Is that the name of it? Or there's something for the coffee?
They have a phrase which I can't remember, but it'll be in the podcast.
We've got such good researchers. Sorry, it's all our fault. It's called something.
It's just the short-term memory that's
I do love though what she said. You know, we're maybe not taking care of the bigger needs, but we're playing a small part in it. But you know, I think for about anything, it's about believing that that small part builds up. You know, and that's the thing that makes a difference. And particularly with churches, you know, working with the people that everyone else kind of just says no. You know, there's no profit here. You know, so yeah, good stuff. Now, as ever, we're very keen to hear your suggestions for future Small Voices, dear listener. So let us know. People are organisations which are small but are making a big difference. So keep them coming by visiting our website smallvoice.org.uk or tweet us at @small_voice1. And time for some more music. The Ayoub sisters are still with us, waiting patiently, and this time they're going to play their version of the traditional tune Ashokan Farewell. Thank you. That was absolutely beautiful. Do you want to tell us about Ashokan Farewell? It's traditional, obviously, quite old.
Yes, Ashokan Farewell, again, is one of those pieces that I associate with being very young and just starting out playing the violin. I think I heard it on the radio and instantly requested for my mum to buy me the music for my 8th birthday, I think it was. I just loved the melody of it. And we decided to arrange a version of it for violin and cello and put it as the farewell track to our album.
Which brings us to the album which I've got here, the Ayub Sisters. Just out of interest, how there are lots of high quality photos in here. How long did that take? Is that like a day?
What, the pictures or the album?
Yeah. No, the pictures. I was thinking you've got a few outfits.
A long day.
That was a 9-hour photo shoot. And there was a wind machine involved. And I think Laura and I had the flu for a while afterwards because we had Scottish gale force winds blowing at us for 9 hours.
At least have had coats on, that's
all. I know.
Now, about the album, I mean, it's great because it's got the classical crossover that you mentioned. You know, people want to hear the classical version of Uptown Funk, you know, which, trust me, everyone at Small Voice knows really well. We don't because we're a bit old. Billie Jean, we've definitely heard of that one. But there's one track I really did want to ask you about, and it's one which I think you've kind of, well, you've arranged yourself and kind of put together. It's called Call to Prayers. So do you want to tell us about that one? Because that's quite intriguing from the Small Voice perspective.
So Laura and I were baptised in the Coptic Orthodox Church. We come from an Egyptian background and grew up with these kind of the chants, the liturgy, which is all sung. And when we'd visit our family in Cairo, we would be greeted by the sound of the Adhan, the Islamic call to prayer, which would sound about 5 times a day. And I don't know if you visited an Islamic country or heard that sound.
I haven't, but
it's quite a hauntingly beautiful sound that we just associate with Cairo being home. And we thought, you know, these melodies are beautiful. And what would happen if we were to kind of compose a piece derived from these melodies and put them together? And that's what we did with the call to prayers.
And you're also kind of making a statement by doing that?
Yeah, I think inevitably putting the Islamic call to prayer and the chants from the Coptic Orthodox liturgy together is a statement. It's, I mean, we've called it call to prayers, a message of unity. And I think the point behind it was to show that these two melodies sound beautiful and strong and work very well when put together, and that hopefully can be an example, not just musically, but wider.
And I think I was chatting to you earlier before the recording, and you said that you don't tend to get asked about that much, certainly in the press that you get in the UK. But I mean, is that quite a bold statement? I mean, have you had any feedback on the track from people who might be saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, I like the first bit, but not the second one? Or
has it been well received? It's definitely been well received. It's controversial. We're not going to shy away from the fact that it's very, both ideas are very precious, and the thought of putting them together might offend some people, but we were trying to look past that and for that particular reason show that this can be a positive message and nothing more than that.
Yeah. Well, I have to say it's a beautiful track and it's a great album as well. So, you know,
thank you.
If people are planning for next year's Christmas, then they're all set. In terms of, we normally say to people, tell us, have you got a website? And they go, oh, no, we've not really got a website, you know, and are you on Twitter? But I mean, come on, you guys can afford a wind machine, or someone can afford a wind machine. So how, if people want to follow you, you're on Facebook?
We are. We're on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram, all at the Ayub Sisters.
Yeah, no one else had taken that one. So you've got, it's the ayubsisters.com for the website So sorted. And concerts coming up later in 2018? Are you planning a tour or a new album? Or what's around the corner?
Are
New Year's resolutions?
Playing as much as possible. I mean, this album, it still feels very, very fresh for us. It only just came out at the end of last year. And trying to bring it to as many people as possible, as many corners of the world, and just share our music with people. That's the aim of 2018.
Yeah, well, listen, we are honoured and really grateful that you've found time in your hectic schedule to be with us. A little call out to Mike Graham, who's through the glass and knows you well, and Mike's the reason that you're here tonight,
which is great of you to do that
for us. But you know, if you're passing again, you know, we're you can find us most Thursday nights. Thank you very much for being with us, Sarah and Laura.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And so finally we come to the Moral Mixdown, wherein we wrestle with one of the great moral, ethical and spiritual issues of the day and debate this in our own unique way, which is to say none of us are going to walk out in a huff if we disagree. Well, 52 shows and counting, so it hasn't happened yet. Who knows? Now, we are going to kind of pick up on some themes from the book that we reviewed in the media review, the book Rebecca Stott's In the Days of Rain, because she talks about growing up in the Brethren, which we refer to as a cult. And certainly in there are practices, shall we say, in terms of how they treat children, which are pretty unpleasant and you would be hard-pressed not to describe them as child abuse. And indeed, I put forward that very view just as we were having coffee before the show over some nice biscuits. Very nice shortbread. And then you said, Anne, well, couldn't that be said about any church or any organised religion? And lo and behold, why don't we run with that as our question? So off you go. Is all organised religion a form of child abuse? What do you think?
Am I allowed to say no, but potentially yes?
You'll have to draw it out a wee bit more.
You're sitting on the fence again there.
Well, potentially, you're saying.
I think potentially. I think every faith tradition carries within it both the possibility of liberation and the possibility of oppression. Isabel Smythe, the wonderful nun who was our Thousand Words interviewee quite recently, has done a lot of work with people from in an interfaith context. And it's too easy to pick somebody else's faith tradition as the one that is abusive. Mm-hmm. When in fact what we need to do, she says, is learn to live well within our own. Because the potential for good and evil sits within every tradition. I don't want to talk about it theoretically, though. I think I'll use my own childhood as the basis for what I mean. I had the most loving parents and in some ways an idyllic childhood. But from the age of three, I did sit in church and listen to preachers who were telling me that unless I and the people I loved said the right formula of words, then God would damn them to eternal punishment in hell. Mm-hmm. And if you were an earnest child with a vivid imagination, as I was, this really troubled me because it meant that if I was constantly worried in case the people I loved had not said the right formula of words. And that led at, I think I've mentioned this before to you guys, at about the age of 6 or 7, actually having the explicit conversation with God that if he would save my mum and my dad and my sister, then I was willing to go to hell. And it was a kind of a bargain that I had with God because the thought of their suffering was so much worse than the thought of suffering myself. Now, if I tell that story outside the context of other Christians, they will immediately say child abuse. Mm-hmm. The reason that it wasn't in the end child abuse was it was mitigated by the fact that I was so loved by my family and by people in the church who really cared about me. And so I was seeing something different from what I was hearing. That was the first thing. And the second thing was that my parents exposed me to all sorts of ideas and all sorts of belief systems outside of the ones that I was hearing in church. And they taught me to use my own conscience as the test. So I was never a candidate for a cult. You know, I would never have been attracted to the exclusive brethren.
That's quite an important thing, isn't it?
It's the absolutely central thing, I think, because if you are not, if you don't have within you that tendency towards being a true believer, if you constantly are being brought back to what your own conscience is telling you, then you're unlikely to find either yourself in an abusive situation or draw others into an abusive situation.
Yeah. Margaret, what do you think?
Well, I was a wee bit concerned, Darren, because I've been involved with children in a church context really for most of my life. So if that were true, then I'm one of the abusers. And sorry, I'd have to admit to it just now. But I, in my defence, I'd say it's done from the best of motives, because those of us who do these things believe that we have something to offer, something that is of benefit to children, a way of life, a way of acting, that is good for them, let alone good for the rest of the world. And I think, you know, I grew up in a context, and I can remember seeing a poster that said children should be seen and not heard. And that was the kind of context of our youth, really, at sort of 5 or 6.
It's the view of many maths teachers, can I just say.
Aye, well, excluding the maths classroom, you have to do that. But I am very much aware now that the children that I am in contact with are not afraid to ask questions, and we try as much as possible to give them honest answers.
Yeah.
You don't have to recite things. You don't have to say the right words. If you can't understand something yourself, you tell them. You know, if a child asks about the Holy Spirit and, you know, God and Jesus, and, well, you know, I heard somebody saying a couple of weeks ago, this is how I understand it.
There is an amusing bit in the book, actually, in Rebecca's book, where I think she asks her father about the Holy Spirit and then decides, no, he doesn't understand it either.
That's right.
You kind of listened to that and thought, yeah, okay. I did like, though, that, sorry to harp back to the book, but you really should read it. She talks about the joy of being told, and again, it was from her friend's Catholic mother, it's okay not to know.
Yeah.
And she says that that's how she tried to bring her children up. It's okay not to know. And I don't know if small voice has a motto. We might get hate mail for saying it, but I think it's not a bad suggestion.
I think that's very important. I think one of the things that struck me, again, in the book was when the leader decided that nobody was to go to university. Rebecca's father was one of the last people who was able to go. Yeah. And I remember hearing that about another religious cult as well. Don't go. And I think because I was brought up to value education.
Yeah.
And that was always the expectation. You know, and somebody who says, oh, no, don't do that, that's where you start to worry.
Now, this is where there's a worry about the present day, because we have the equivalent now with people who won't let their kids take science classes because it seems to conflict with their creation beliefs. Well, why not? You have to be exposed to other worldviews.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, on the plus side, I would say, in terms of if people are worried about indoctrination in Sunday school, other than fabulous people like Anna who do Sunday school so well, to be honest, drawing round your hand and writing Jesus in the middle, you needn't worry too much. The kids are really just busy enjoying drawing round their hand, and every bit of educational theory I've ever read says that basically when you ask them, what did you learn today in Sunday school, they just say something about Jesus, but really what they did was draw round their hand and coloured it in. So you don't have to worry too much, and I should say, come back next month, maybe we'll discuss if bringing your child up as a strict atheist is a form of child abuse, but I'm kind of going too far in the opposite direction. Well, faithful listener, that's about it from us this month. We hope you enjoyed the show, and if you did, then why not take advantage of our exciting buy one, get one free offer, which I've only just made up. In fact, you can subscribe to us entirely free via your podcast provider, or stop by our website smallvoice.org.uk, where you can also leave a comment or tweet us at small_voice1. And if you subscribe before the end of the month, we'll also send you a free Small Voice crossword puzzle, a life-size photo of the Small Voice team, and a signed plate of mince and tatties. Okay, so I made all that up as well, but we're working on the crossword puzzle. Honest.